Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. I'm Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with A.H. Kim about her latest novel, Relative Strangers. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners over at patreon.com/booksandboba, where our Patreon supporters gain access to our members-only Discord server, monthly bonus podcasts, as well as the opportunity to suggest future book club picks. So if you'd like to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over and become a supporter. We had a great chat with Anne about her latest novel, Relative Strangers, is a contemporary adaptation of Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibilities, with the Korean-American Baywood sisters taking the place of the original work's Dashwood sisters. And it was a lot of fun. As someone who has no previous experience with Sense and Sensibility, it was kind of fun to go in cold and then kind of learning about the original story and the changes that Anne made to it.
Yeah, for me, it was fun reading the book, knowing what was going to happen, what twists of what dark family secrets were gonna come up. And I was like, how is this going to be modernized? How is this going to surprise me? And I was very pleasantly surprised. I had a fun time reading this book.
Yeah, so without further ado, please enjoy our author chat with A.H. Kim.
And we're here with A.H. Kim, a.k.a. Anne, the author of A Good Family. And we are here to talk about her latest novel, Relative Strangers. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
So I'm looking at your bio and it looks like you have an incredible story of being a Harvard College graduate, going to law school, being a head of investor relations at a Fortune 200 company. These are things that are kind of on the far opposite side of creative writing, shall we say. So we like to ask our authors at the top of each interview, like, how did you get into writing? Like, was this something that you were always interested in, or was it a passion that came later in life?
Yeah. So we were talking earlier about how, you know, we're all kind of immigrants or, you know, first generation people. And so I was an immigrant. I moved here when I was just shy of 2 years old. And, you know, it's a classic immigrant story where they came here to get a better life. A better life typically means being a doctor or a lawyer or a professor or, you know, engineer. So I had absolutely no inklings at all that I ever wanted to be a writer. Even though I enjoyed writing when I was in elementary and middle school, you know, it was kind of the kind of thing that you just enjoy doing, but you would never consider pursuing a career in it. So, you know, I was kind of your model minority student, did really well in school, went to Harvard, went to law school, got myself a great corporate job. And then it wasn't until I was in my 40s and I was on vacation and I was, you know, I've always loved to read. And I was reading John Green's YA book, The Fault in Our Stars. And I don't know if you've read it, but it's, you know, it's very emotional. It's about first love. It's about kids who have cancer. And I was just a weeping, sad mess at the end of it. And I was like, oh, that book was so good. I love that book. And I realized that, like, I had never read a YA book written from a Korean American perspective. And this was like over 10 years ago. I mean, since then, there have been YA books from a Korean American perspective, but at the time, there hadn't been. And so I was like, I want to write a YA book from a Korean American perspective. And so I did. I just did it in my spare time while I was not working my day job and I wasn't raising my kids and all those things. And I wrote the YA book, but wasn't able to, you know, get it published. I wasn't able to get an agent or anything. But I had sort of, it was like I had been bitten by this writing bug. And I thought, well, I wrote one book and it was really fun to write. And I had so much, I got so much like pleasure out of just telling my story that I thought I would write another book. And that second book ended up becoming published and was a good family.
Yeah. So it's always interesting to like hear these stories, right? Because these days there's a lot of kids in their 20s getting published right out of college. And it's really good to see, like, it could also happen to, you know, someone who is switching careers or coming out from a different career. And I wanted to ask, how did you go about learning how to write a novel? Like, did you take any classes? Did you use any resources? Like, how did you teach yourself this craft?
Yeah, I always tell people that the best training to be a writer is to be a reader. Because the more you read, the more I think you know what kinds of books you like, the more you kind of almost start to intuit sort of the beats that a book has to have. You know, you have to, I mean, usually I like books that kind of like capture, you know, my attention right away. You know, that's kind of called the hook. You know, usually I like to have a nice resolution at the end. I don't love books that just keep me kind of like up in the air. I mean, some people like those kinds of books, but I know what kinds of books I like to read. And so naturally that turned into the kinds of books that I like to write. That first book that I wrote, that YA book, I wasn't able to get, you know, an agent or any kind of publication interest into it. And I realized that part of it was that it was just sort of like this free-flowing stream of ideas, but it didn't really have like a plot or it didn't have like a hook. And I realized that that was part of what I needed to learn how to do. So then I did start to read books about like how to structure novels. I think there is a book that's actually called How to Structure Your Novel. And, you know, it gives you some ideas about which beats you want to have in a book. And then there's like books like Save the Cat, which are actually about screenwriting, but also mm-hmm. give you the idea of like the kinds of things you need to have in a narrative of any sort to capture people's attention. And so I did use that for my second book to give me an idea of like, okay, I'm about halfway through the book. I should have a climax at this point. But I need to have a couple more kind of wrinkles in the story before I reach the resolution. So sort of having that first book that went nowhere and then doing some research into novel structure did help me with my second book.
I do love how YA was the gateway into you finding novel writing. I feel like a lot of people who are not part of this reading and writing community, they belittle YA, saying like, oh, it's for teen girls and it's not as like mature. But obviously, like Fault in Our Stars, it like struck you. It had like an emotional connection to you. And I just love that is what pushed you into creative writing. Your debut novel, A Good Family, it came out in 2020. And I'm guessing that writing it and trying to go promote it during the height of the pandemic was an experience like no other. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it was my first book, so I was really going into it cold. I didn't know, you know, would I get a book tour? You know, would I have book signings? Would I have like huge audiences? Would I have no audience? So it was all kind of a mystery to me going into the debut year. And then, of course, my book came out in July. Then, of course, March happened and everything closed down. So even if I had a book tour or book signings planned, those would have all gone by the wayside. So we were all kind of just, all of us who were debuting that year were kind of scrambling. And the saving grace of that year was that one of my friends, Angie Kim, who's also an author, had told me that every year there's a Facebook group that forms for authors who debut that year. And so she got me the name of the person who was organizing the group for 2020. And I joined that group, you know, in 2019. And so as things started to fall apart and as, you know, book tours were canceled, as book signings were canceled, as everything started to go online, that Facebook group became a lifeline. And we just basically leaned on each other to sort of learn, you know, how to launch a book in a pandemic. So there would be questions like, has anybody heard of Instagram Live? What is that? Or, you know, like, somebody told me they wanted to do something on Zoom. Do you know what that is? Does that cost money? And, you know, like, it was just like, we were all just like the blind leading the blind at the time. And, you know, it was like a great support group too, as we were all kind of, you know, this was something that all of us were looking forward to for years. And all of a sudden everything was taken away. So it was a great support group to just sort of talk about how hard it was to be disappointed, you know, with our book launches. But the, you know, the plus side of that was that I was able to actually do virtual events. I think I, you know, I did maybe a half dozen of them. And a lot of times with the debut author, there's not really much of a budget to do a tour or travel. But because these were virtual, suddenly I had people from all parts of my life who showed up at my book events. So it wasn't just the people who lived in my hometown, but it was the people who lived, you know, across the country that I went to school with, who would just pop up on my screen. I'd be like, oh my gosh, hi, you know, like, so great to see you. So there were some silver linings to debuting in a pandemic, but I would say, you know, it, most of all, it was kind of a disappointment. And I think the contrast now between that and my book launch that's coming up in a month is huge. You know, like, I have an actual tour. I have signings. I have my friends saying they're going to see me in California or they're going to see me in Virginia. There's just so much excitement and joy building up for the launch of my next book. So I didn't know what I was missing, but I'm really looking forward to my next book.
Yeah. I guess with that, we should move on to your upcoming book, Relative Strangers. Can you tell us what your book's about?
Sure. So the kind of the quick description of it is a modern day retelling of Sense and Sensibility with two Korean American sisters set in Northern California. A lot of times people will react to that and say like, oh, you know, I've never read any Jane Austen, or, oh, I've never read Sense and Sensibility. And as I like to say, you know, this is not a test. This is not a quiz. You will not have to like recognize characters or recognize themes in order to read this book. It's completely a standalone book. So you can read this book without ever having even heard of Jane Austen. But if you have read the Sense and Sensibility, or if you've seen the movie, which is actually just as much an inspiration to me as the book, then, you know, you'll get some little like inside jokes or a little allusion. So it'll be even more fun, but you're totally able to enjoy the book without having read or seen any Jane Austen.
Yes. Austen, I've said it multiple times on this podcast, is kind of like a cultural blind spot for me. Like, I've read enough Pride and Prejudice adaptations to like be able to key in on those tropes, but I myself have never read Sense and Sensibility or was familiar with the story before going in. So it was kind of interesting to read your story kind of cold to the tropes, but I did catch up on the original story afterwards and was really interested in seeing like all the different themes and characters that you pulled into your story. Adapting Austen is, you know, you mentioned in your afterword, is a daunting task, where there's a lot of people that are really love these stories and will like, you know, comb over, you know, your adaptation. What was that experience like? Why did you decide to adapt Sense and Sensibility? And how was the experience of turning it into like a Korean American story?
Yeah. So, you know, going back to my first book, A Good Family. So first of all, I had written that YA book. It went nowhere. I mean, that whole process was like 2-3 years of writing and then trying to find an agent. So I spent 3 years on something that went nowhere. Then I wrote my second book, A Good Family, and I was trying it again, trying to find an agent, and it was sort of going nowhere again. And so I was, you know, I was kind of feeling kind of miserable because, you know, I'm usually the kind of person that when I set my goal, I achieve it. You know, I'm very like driven and goal oriented. So I was kind of having like one of those meltdown moments where, you know, I was like, my book's going nowhere. This dream of mine to be published is not going to happen. And so, you know, I was comforting myself by watching one of my favorite movies, which is Sense and Sensibility. So, you know, there I am, like eating my Ben and Jerry's ice cream, you know, sort of like weeping into my shirt. And I just thought, oh, I love this movie so much. It's like so comforting to me. It's like a warm blanket. And then I thought to myself, oh, wouldn't it be fun to write an adaptation of this story? But the one thing I like don't like about Jane Austen, I love everything about Jane Austen, but the one thing I don't like is, you know, it's all like white people, English people who are like pretty much rich. I mean, you know, sometimes they fall in quote hard times, but they're still like, they have food and everything, you know, they're fine. So I thought, oh, I'd love to take Jane Austen, but bring it into the modern world and to diversify it and to make it with Korean American characters, but not just Korean American characters, you know, they'll have like African-American characters and Indian-American characters and, you know, all sorts of just like, you know, I lived in Northern California. I lived in San Francisco Bay Area. So, you know, I knew people of all different backgrounds and gender identities and sexual identities. And so I thought that's the world that I want to occupy, not this like refined British countryside thing. So that was the genesis of the book. And I started to write it. I say that just a sense of sensibility was my comfort watch. Relative Strangers was my comfort write. It was just so much fun to write this book and to infuse it with all the things that I love. So I love pop culture. I love food. I love nature. So all of those elements that I love in my life, I just infused it in the book, all kind of with the structure of the Jane Austen story.
I'm so glad that you said that the Sense and Sensibility 1995 movie, it was such a comfort film to you, because it is also very much a comfort film for me. And for those of you out there who have never watched the 1995 adaptation, it's directed by Ang Lee, directed by an Asian director. And, you know, it's just so like funny to me that like we as Asians, we do have like kind of like a foothold in the Austen adaptation world. And it's like Sense and Sensibility, in the 1995 movie, it is like declared as like one of the most beloved period pieces out there. So
yeah,
it's just like being able to see an Asian name right next to like Jane Austen's name and be like, okay, yeah, we have like the authority to make the story our own or to adapt it. Like no one can really tell us that we're not qualified to tell this type of story. I think it's just really funny as time went on, we're getting more and more Asian American, Asian Canadian adaptations of Austen stories. What was it about Sense and Sensibility that was so comforting to you?
Well, first of all, I love sister stories. I have a sister myself, and my sister can be both my best friend and also my like greatest arch nemesis, you know? So it's like that relationship between sisters. I don't know. I find it just very charming and troubled and interesting. So I love the relationship between Eleanor and Marianne. And I, as the older sister, you know, relate, of course, much more to Eleanor, the sensible sister who's like very reasonable and rational. And my younger sister is more like the Kate Winslet character of Marianne, a little more kind of impetuous and vivacious. And I just love how, despite their differences, you know, there's just love between them and they support each other through everything. Of course, I love the romance and the kind of who will they end up with, you know, the mystery of like, which man are they going to end up with? The scenery is so gorgeous. Like, you know, the English countryside is so beautiful. And then I just love all these little like tiny like comedy of errors or comedy of manners. And I think that's what Ang Lee is really great at. Maybe it's because of his foreignness or his outsiderness, but he also did The Ice Storm. And I can't remember the other movies that he's done, but he's, you know, I think he does these movies that sometimes from the outside, it's like, well, why would, you know, an Asian man direct that film? But I think he has such an eye for like cultural nuance and detail and manners that he brings out to all of his films. So I don't, it's just a beautiful movie. It's got such a lovely, you know, it's got a happy ending. What's not to love?
I like the fact that you have a sister and you have like such a close bond with her as well. I'm like, yeah, it feels like while I was reading the book, I was like, this feels like it was being written by someone who has a sister and like knows that relationship in and out. But I'm curious, like, what was it like writing solely from Amelia's perspective? Because the original, it's written from a third omniscient narrator. And everyone's pasts and history and twists are all delivered in like this all-knowing manner. But for you, you're writing from this one character's point of view. And this one character is kind of a mess and yeah. is stuck in arrested development. So how is it writing your entire story through her eyes?
Yeah, I think that it's true that Austin wrote from a third person omniscient perspective. And, you know, not that you necessarily have a perspective in a film, but I felt like, you know, the Ang Lee film version was also kind of third person, you know, it was like it was objective. But I also sort of felt like in a weird way, it was told from Eleanor's perspective. Like, you know, Eleanor was the very sensible one. And Marianne, who in my book is called Amelia, was like kind of her reactions to things sometimes seemed sort of foolish or frivolous or whatever. And so I kind of thought, well, maybe let's give Amelia or Marianne her turn. Let's let her tell her side of the story and not just, you know, have the story be told from this rational perspective. And I think the other thing too, besides giving Amelia her due, is that like, it would have been easier for me to write it from the Eleanor perspective, because that is the perspective that I feel more kind of similar to. But that is not as much of a fun writing exercise. It's really fun to sort of try to put yourself into the body or the psyche of somebody that is so different from you, and to channel like, what must it be like to be so out of control or so, you know, at a loss in your life? And how would she perceive the world? So I thought it was much more exciting and interesting to write from Amelia's perspective than from a third person omniscient or even Eleanor's perspective.
Yeah, like Sense and Sensibility, like it's so everlasting because it's a commentary on how like the patriarchal social institutions control women's autonomy, right? Like through marriage, male inheritance, pregnancy. These women are shaped by their circumstances. And Jane Austen really goes into detail, like what it's like to navigate a woman's life during these times. And I found it interesting how Amelia in your story has a history of being codependent on men. And she knows this. She knows this is a problem, but she struggles with it so much. And I just think it's really funny how different it is from the original, like in Regency time era, like the whole point is to be codependent on a man. That is your goal. That is your security. So can you tell us more about like how you developed Amelia's personal growth and her relationships with the other other male characters?
Yeah. I mean, I think your observation about patriarchy is spot on, because, you know, that is so much a part of the Austen world. You know, the idea that they can't go out and get a job on their own. They can't, you know, be independent. They do depend on, you know, whether their father inherits the estate or not. Fast forward to modern days, and we're supposed to be, you know, liberated women, and yet we still live in a patriarchal world. And some of it is a large part of it is imposed upon us. And yet, you know, I see my friends, and some of them, it's kind of, I don't know if it's they impose it upon themselves or somehow they absorb it as part of the culture that we're surrounded by. But, you know, I think in some ways Amelia is, I hate to use the word victim because she's not a victim, but, you know, she has somehow become codependent on men. And that's her, I mean, if you really get to the heart of the story, that is the struggle that's in the story, is that, she, you know, she starts out basically homeless with no money, no place to live, not even enough, you know, cash to get herself from Palo Alto up to Marin County. And then she, from there, she just basically leeches off her sister Eleanor for a while. And, you know, she just doesn't know how she got here. I mean, she just, how did she continue to just sort of glom onto man after man and not find her own way? And so, you know, the story of Relative Strangers is in many ways the story of Amelia finding herself and finding her own strength. But even like Eleanor, if you think about it, you know, she's got elements of patriarchy or things that she's dealing with in her life. Certainly their mother, Tabitha, I mean, she's was basically a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, now she doesn't know how to, you know, she's lost her entire fortune. So each of them, I think, in some ways is dealing with the patriarchy and figuring out how they make their own way in this world.
Yeah, as an older, as a woman in my 30s reading about Amelia's relationships, I'm like, girl, for real? Like, this guy is a red flag. Like, why are you risking so much? But I guess, you know, like, you know, hindsight is 2020.
I did love the slowly unraveling mystery of her and her, like, long-term ex and what got them into trouble with the law, which, you know, you hint at and then you eventually reveal. I'm not going to reveal on this podcast because it's worth reading just to get to that part. But I was laughing out loud when I got to that. As someone who likes frequenting, you know, fine dining restaurants, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I do love food. I love trying the latest restaurants. I love, you know, watching, you know, the Food Network and watching cooking competitions and all those things. But I do think sometimes the foodie world can get very, very precious. And this was sort of almost like a spoof on how precious the foodie world can be.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of the movie The Menu came out in 2022.
Yes.
And it was kind of like a spoof on fine dining. And I'm like, oh, I'm guessing that is the kind of world that Amelia and her ex comes from. And it's really cool that you are a big foodie and that kind of influenced your work. But in your bio, it says that you're a longtime cancer survivor, and you explore the struggles of cancer patients and their spouses really compassionately in the book. And I just really love the scene where Gisella tells Amelia that cancer is not a failure of self-care and that people shouldn't be judged for being sick. And as someone who, you know, is healthy and able-bodied, that it was very like enlightening to me to get that side of the story. Can you tell us about how your own experience with cancer helped you write this book?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with cancer when I was in my late 30s. My kids were young at the time. They were 3 and they were 6. And my first thought was, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. And my kids are only 3 and 6. And so they're not, you know, maybe my 6-year-old will remember little bits of me, but probably my 3-year-old wouldn't. And, you know, it was an awful time. You know, it's like you just come face to face with your own mortality. But after, you know, that kind of initial shock, you know, in some ways it gave me great courage. I thought, well, gosh, if I can get through this, I can, you know, like anything else in my life, you know, like I can get through anything. So it did give me great courage. It also introduced me to a community of other cancer survivors. So I joined a support group. Those women became some of my best friends. And through that support group, I was introduced to a cancer retreat center in Northern California called Commonweal. And that is the basis for Arcadia. So Arcadia is based on an actual cancer retreat center that exists out there. And as beautiful and as idyllic as Arcadia, I hope, is written, Commonweal is actually 10 times more beautiful and idyllic than that. But, you know, when you go through cancer, yeah, a lot of those scenes that are in Arcadia or, you know, related to some of the characters were definitely drawn from my own life. So, for example, you know, I did have people ask me, oh, you know, like, you look like you're healthy, but you got cancer. So like, do you have a family history? Like, do you exercise? Do you eat red meat? And I was sort of like, why are you asking me these questions? It's like, you know, like, okay, maybe I don't exercise, but does that mean that's why I got cancer when I was in my late 30s? Like, there are plenty of people who don't exercise who, you know, don't get cancer, or I don't eat that much red meat. I'm sure there are many people who eat a lot of red meat and they don't get cancer. So I kind of didn't understand why people were asking me these questions, and it was very hurtful. And I realized in the end that people ask those questions because they're afraid. You know, they're afraid that they'll get cancer. So they think, okay, well, if I don't do what she did, or if I do what she didn't do, then maybe I won't get it. But it was, you know, I try not to like bop people over the head with like life lessons or, you know, moral of the story or whatever. But I do like to kind of interject little things that maybe people will think, oh, wow, I've asked those questions before and maybe I shouldn't do it again. Or, you know, just even I don't make my books about diversity or about othering or about the patriarchy, but those are all ideas that are infused into my books. And so hopefully by reading them, you kind of learn in the process. So I always like to say, I kind of like sort of sneakily put in these little life lessons in a book that's otherwise seems kind of, you know, just like a fun, frothy book.
It doesn't hurt that your setting provides like the pastoral landscape for a good Austen adaptation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I was thinking about Sense and Sensibility, in the original novel, they go off to live in sort of a country cottage owned by a distant relative. And so I started to think, like, what's kind of the modern day equivalent of a country cottage? And the first thing that came to mind was Commonweal, this place that I had gone. And I also, I mean, some books these days, they have a lot of like texting and they have a lot of like DMs and stuff like that, you know, to kind of keep it modern. But I actually wanted to keep sort of an old fashioned feel to the book so that people weren't constantly checking their Instagram profiles or constantly like online. And so setting them in a place where there was no Wi-Fi, where there was really poor cell reception, allowed them to sort of retreat, you know, into their own little bubble of a place. And so that was really fun to me as well.
Yeah, and it was really poignant because you have characters who are going through so much and they are like healing from like past relationships or recent losses. And it's like a perfect setting for them to reflect and not have technology be interfering with their life like constantly. I kind of wish that I had a place like that because the internet is a dark place.
Very much so. I mean, at the same time, you know, it's a place that brings us podcasts like yours, and it's a place, you know, like, and honestly, like I have a love-hate relationship with social media, but through my social media, you know, I have readers who like reach out to me and tell me that they've really enjoyed my books. And that, you know, just even one note from a reader who says that just makes your whole day. So there's definitely pluses and minuses to being connected. And, you know, I say to myself sometimes, oh, I should just like have a day where like I don't even check my, you know, social media at all. And boy, is that hard.
Yeah, I'm reminded of, so there's this like complex of tiny cabins for like, you know, glamping up here in like the Big Bear Mountains. And one of their main selling points is like, there's no cell reception up here. Come here, up here and like totally disconnect. And so me and my wife went there, but we could totally still connect to the internet. I think they improved the cell tower coverage up there.
Oh, no.
So
totally defeated the
point. See, for me, my paranoid true crime ass would be like, no cell signal, like no Wi-Fi. What if I get killed? What if there's a bear? Like, I would just die without any, like, with like nobody near me, no hospitals near me either. And this is kind of like an issue for some of your characters later on. And I just thought it was like really brilliant. But yeah, like, so you have a character named Maggie, who is Eleanor's daughter, and she's an adaptation of the youngest Dashwood sister. And Maggie reminds me of so many overachieving Asian American high school students. Like, the pressure is so high compared to when I was applying for colleges, which was a long time ago. But what I loved was how, even though she has this pressure to enroll into an elite college, and her mother expects a great deal from Maggie. Her mother also understands that Maggie is not happy and she's not healthy in her current school environment. And she takes her out of school, and Maggie has this chance to be privately tutored and to kind of like pursue her own education. And that's a relationship that we don't really quite see in a lot of Asian American stories, because I feel like we vilify the parents quite often, or the parents are a little bit too harsh. And that conversation between first gen and second gen, there's a lot of clashing. Can you talk about like how you develop their mother-daughter relationship, and also how like Maggie opens up to Amelia, and how their relationship helps the sisters' relationships themselves?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you keyed in on that, because I haven't been asked very much about Maggie. I mean, she's sort of like the forgotten, in the original Sense and Sensibility, she's sort of like the forgotten third sister. All she does is basically accompany Amelia as she gets like, you know, lost in the rain and stuff like that. And so in the book, her name is Margaret, but in my version, I name her Maggie. I didn't feel like there was a space for another sister in my version of it. And I thought that it would be interesting to have a daughter slash niece in the book. So that's why I turned Margaret, the sister, into Maggie, you know, the daughter. I think around the time, I don't think it was around the time that I was originally drafting Relative Strangers, but probably when I was doing my first round of revisions, my older son was applying to college. And I saw how much pressure all these kids were under, you know, my son, as well as his classmates. And, you know, the questions that they ask on the college admissions applications, you know, it's like, what's your major? What's your passion? What's your, you know, what do you want to do in your life? And I was like, these kids are, you know, 17 years old, you know, they want to just like play their Game Boy and like watch TV and like hang out with their friends. You know, like, when did it become a prerequisite that you need to know what the rest of your life is going to look like for you to be able to go to college? And I kind of absorbed all this like anxiety that my son was feeling and that his friends were feeling. And then I also sort of reflected back to my teenage years when I was applying to school and the kinds of pressures that I was personally feeling. And so I kind of put all of those feelings of anxiety and stress and self-doubt into Maggie. And at first, you know, her mom, Eleanor, is sort of like your typical Asian immigrant mom who wants them to like do really well and to go to the top schools and stuff. She's also very controlling. So she only wants her to go within like a 5-hour drive of where she lives. And so she really wants to circumscribe her child's life to keep her safe, which is understandable. I mean, she's been widowed at a young age, you know, she's trying to hold her family together. And so she feels like the more control she exercises in her life, the fewer chances that things will go wrong. And that's kind of the story of her life, as opposed to Amelia, who lives like the opposite way and like interjects as much randomness and lack of control as possible. So I kind of liked that dynamic. And I thought also, like, just as I liked reading YA books, you know, there are sort of young adult readers who want to read adult books too. And I felt like this could be a real crossover kind of issue that people could relate to. This makes it seem like I gave it all this like conscious thought. I think it just flowed out naturally from me. And then the final thing I'll say is that I have a niece, you know, my sister's daughter is my niece. And I love that relationship. And my brother has daughters too. And so I love that relationship with my nieces. I can be kind of like the bonus mom or the fun mom. You know, I can like take them out shopping, or I can, you know, I don't know, go out and get a boba with them. And so I get all the fun parts of being a mom without any of the stresses. and so I wanted to build that relationship in between Amelia and Maggie.
I think you did a beautiful job, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, your book has a ton of characters. And I think this is just what it means to, you know, adapt an Austen book, right? Because Austen books have tons of characters. And I'm just curious, in terms of like, not only do you have a lot of characters, but they all have long histories with each other and overlapping histories. How did you develop that? Like, did you have like a whole spreadsheet or like one of those like line board things? Like, this person knows this person from this time. They dated this person, but now they're with this person. You know, like
I will add the fact that like if you are rich, like the pool is very small. So I'm guessing that helped a lot.
Well, so I did because I had sort of a book to start with. So unlike my first book where it was completely, you know, made up, I did have Austin's book to start with. So, you know, I did have the list of characters. I think even at the beginning of the book, I think they actually even have a list of characters, but I can't remember. And so, you know, I did do sort of like not exactly a spreadsheet, but a list of the names. And then I sort of brainstormed updated names for them. So like Eleanor in Sense and Sensibility is spelled with an I, E-L-I-N-O, you know, O-R. And so in my version, she spelled the normal way with the E-A. Marianne, I changed her to Amelia because Marianne is actually a character in that first YA book that I wrote. And even though like that book went nowhere, it'll probably go nowhere ever in its entire life, I still like have this like little hope that, oh, well, maybe someday I'll go back to that first book. And Marianne, that like there's a meaning to that name. So I couldn't touch that name. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give her a completely new name. So, and then like Margaret to Maggie, I was, you know, trying to update things. But like I said, so I started with the names and the characters. And then I also started to think about their relationships. Like, okay, this is going to be the cast of like potential suitors or date, you know, people to marry. And then, like I said, you know, the main thing I wanted to do was to diversify the cast. So then I started to think, okay, how can, you know, who are some of these characters and how can I diversify them? And then from that kind of like very quick sketch, what I did is I wrote a series of like first person narrations. It's almost like, you know, like an icebreaker at your corporate retreat or something where you'd be like, hi, my name is Marvin and I'm a first generation Chinese Canadian immigrant, you know, and then like, so you just introduced yourself. And so I had all of these characters introduce themselves to me, which was a super fun writing exercise because it's not like writing a novel. You're just writing a self-introduction. But the more I got into these self-introductions and the more I kind of fleshed them out, the more these people actually started to feel like real people to me. And so once I kind of had all of their backstories, then I could start like taking apart the strands and weaving them into my story and revealing those connections and strands as the book goes on.
Yeah, I love the diversity of your cast. And I think it provided some level of complexity to the male characters, because I will say in the original Jane Austen Sense and Sensibility, the men are despicable. They are all scheming. And even the good ones, I'm like, are they really that good? I don't know. They made some stupid mistakes when they were young, and I don't think they're that honorable in the end, but you know, to each their own. How was it like fleshing out the suitors, the male characters in your book? And just like a sidebar, I thought it was really cool that Hari, what was the character's name? Hari, who is the
equivalent? Hari Mystery?
Oh, yeah.
Well, so his equivalent would be Willoughby.
Okay, Willoughby, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. I just love that how Hari is, you know, he is of Indian descent and he's like this playboy who's very like desirable. And I'm like, yeah, we got a hot Asian like male lead love interest. I love it because we all simp over white men in a lot of these adaptations. So I was like really happy about it. But going back to the original question, how was it developing the male characters in your version?
Yeah, it's a, thank you also for noticing that I put some hot Asian men in this. You probably have not read my first book, A Good Family, but in that story, the male lead is named Sam. And I think I describe him as like a cross between Daniel Dae Kim and Yul Kwon, who won Survivor. And the reason I wrote that was for that same reason. Like, I was tired of books that like never had a hot Asian male lead. And, you know, when my brother was growing up, there was, you know, the Asian characters in movies and, well, first of all, they weren't in books, but if they were in a movie, they were all like, you know, buck teeth, you know, squinty eyed, you know, very nerdy. And so I just really wanted to give a hot Asian male lead in my book. So similarly in Relative Strangers, I wanted to populate it with, you know, diverse characters who all happen to be hot too. Let's see. And so in my first book, I think a lot of what people would say is that, like, you know, most of the characters were unlikable, but particularly the men were unlikable. And that kind of hurts my feelings because I actually love my characters, but I could see why they would say that about the men in particular with my first book. So in my second book, I really wanted to give flesh everybody out so that even the despicable characters had a humanity to them. You could kind of see why they made the bad decisions or why they did what they did. And so even some of the characters who are like, I mean, I will say like Jet, he's a good guy, but he did some bad things, you know, in his past, and he worked hard to kind of apologize for it and get past it. You know, Hari, yeah, he ends up being kind of a jerk, but yeah, I don't know, like there's a part of him that hopefully people will like.
I mean, he's a sincere character, you know?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. You're just like, he makes a lot of mistakes, but you're like, oh, he's someone who kind of puts his heart on his sleeve. And like, how can you not be drawn and charmed by somebody like that?
I was talking with a friend who's probably a bigger Austin fan than I am even. And she noted that in Jane Austen's original book, Sense and Sensibility, there's a scene where Willoughby comes to Eleanor, or I think he comes to her or either writes her a letter or meets her in person to kind of explain himself, to apologize and explain himself. And as if almost to kind of try to redeem him a little bit. But in the Ang Lee movie version, which Emma Thompson wrote the screenplay for, she gets rid of that scene. I mean, I think she has like Eleanor read a letter from him and then she kind of like tosses it aside. But she really takes away that kind of apology redemption aspect of Willoughby in the film. So in my version, I won't give away any spoilers, but you know, I do try to make him sort of more understandable or human, even though he, you know, is kind of a cat.
Like, I mean, it's funny how you say spoilers because this is based on an existing book and like an existing ending. And Marvin went into this book cold, but I knew the story very well. So for me, I was just like, okay, like these men, they're green flags now, but when are they going to turn into red flags? Like, when am I going to see them kind of show their true colors? And in the end, they've kind of showed their true colors the entire time. And I was like, okay, maybe I was just being a little too harsh on the male characters just from my previous prejudice against these characters in the original work. So it was fun reading this book, knowing the characters that they're based off of, knowing like kind of the twists and kind of waiting for them to happen, but not knowing how they were going to happen because now this is in a modern setting with older characters. I'm like, I don't know, how can she make this as dramatic and as much of a hot mess it was like in the original? So this is kind of like a throwaway question, but I wanted to ask anyway. Because as someone who went to film school and as someone who like loves Jane Austen as well, I couldn't help but notice that the Baywoods, they seem to have a love for movies. Like they recite movie lines as like inside jokes and shorthand for like how they feel. Like there's a lot of puns and references to like old movies like Pretty Women and like instead of like you had me at hello, you had me at hell no. So you have like all these very clever references to movies and pop culture. Are you a big movie watcher yourself? I know we talked about Ang Lee film, but like, do you watch a lot of movies? Is that like a big part of your life?
Yeah, I love movies. I've always loved movies. In fact, when I was in high school, and this was, you know, like right around the time the cable was coming out. So this was a long time ago. But, you know, mostly we used to watch things, you know, as they were being broadcast. I would go through the TV guide and like there was always like a midnight movie and it was always like a black and white movie starring Cary Grant or Katharine Hepburn or Audrey Hepburn. And I was just like, I would just like circle all the black and white movies and I would stay up until like 3 o'clock in the morning watching whatever that midnight show was. And so I had like an encyclopedic knowledge of all these like old classic movies, you know, by the time I went to college. And then, you know, and then I loved movies in college. I probably had sort of a dry spell when I had kids because the only thing we could ever watch was like, you know, Disney movies, which were fine, but not, you know, weren't that film fantastic. And then I've moved recently to Ann Arbor. And so I became a member of the local kind of local theater and, you know, you get free tickets to go to the shows and stuff like that. So yes, I love movies. And I think being an immigrant in particular, my siblings and I, we watched a lot of TV. We watched a lot of movies. Just, it was just our way of understanding like how America worked because, you know, the only other role models we had were our parents and our parents spoke Korean. They ate Korean food. They had Korean friends. So we didn't like really, to understand the mores and the cultures and stuff of American life. We just learned it through pop culture. And so, you know, all of those inside jokes that the Baywood sisters have between each other, those were like jokes that my siblings and I would tell each other. I mean, we have even more inside jokes than those, but I mean, I didn't want to, I actually wrote way more like film and inside jokes than are even in the book. And then I just edited like half of them out because it's like, it's too much, you know, people are going to be like, why is she always making a joke? So that's very much the flavor of the humor and all the references are very much true to like what I enjoy in my life.
I definitely got like Gilmore Girls vibes from the book. I'm like, oh yeah, like the mother and daughter, like the sister, everybody is just talking in pop culture references. And if you know those pop culture references, they like the jokes really land. So as someone who's watched a lot of those movies, I was like, okay, this is really funny. I don't know about like other readers out there whose pop culture knowledge might be a little less, but I still think the jokes would be pretty funny for those readers.
Yeah, for the most part, if they're like, I mean, some of them like, you had me at hell no. Like, I don't explain that one. I just leave it at that. And so like, if you didn't get the reference, that's fine. Like, it's not like you're scratching your head. I mean, it still makes sense in the context of the story. But there are other parts where I will say, oh, you know, what's that a line from? Oh, that's a line from this movie. Like, you know, so I, at various points, I do try to like spell it out for the reader because I realize not everybody has the same encyclopedic knowledge of movie references.
Yeah, I'm surprised like that you did not. I'm surprised that you did not mention like Pride and Prejudice as one of the references that your characters keep throwing out.
There was a Darcy reference in there.
Oh, there
sure.
was a Darcy reference. Yeah, you're right.
There's a Darcy reference where she talks about like where Amelia's teasing Brandon about like, you know, his shirt clinging to his body. And it actually starts off at the very beginning where Amelia and Eleanor are in bed together, like after Amelia comes in out of the rain. And there's a line where she says, oh, your hands are cold. And then she says, why doesn't she tell him that she loves him? That's exactly from Pride and Prejudice. Yeah.
It's from the 2015 movie.
It's from the Keira Knightley version. Exactly.
The Keira Knightley version. And then the wet shirt in the rain, that's from the 95 TV series.
Exactly.
I am an expert.
You know it. Exactly.
I will say a part of my soul just died when Rira mentioned Pretty Woman as an old movie.
It is an old movie. It is old. We're in the 2020s.
I agree with you, Marvin. I was, you know, they tell you not to read your Goodreads reviews, but, you know, who can resist? And one of the early Goodreads reviews said something like, you know, some of the references are so dated. And I'm like, what references are dated? Like, what are you talking about? They're not dated.
I mean, like, Pretty Woman and I are the same age.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it is technically an old movie. Oh, goodness.
Oh, my gosh.
I just made a lot of people feel old. And I also outed myself as a millennial, as an older millennial. But we're winding down to the end of the interview. I just wanted to ask, like, is there anything else you're working on, or is it primarily focusing on this book for promotion?
So the funny thing is that when I had finished writing this book and I was getting ready to give it to my publisher, an announcement went out in Publishers Marketplace that my publisher had bought a retelling of Sense and Sensibility. And I was just like, I called my agent up. I was like, oh my gosh, what are the chances, you know, that anyway, that, you know, two Sense and Sensibility retellings would be kind of written at the same time and that they would like both go to my publisher. So I figured, okay, this book is dead in the water. There's no way that my publisher is going to buy this second book. So I actually wrote a complete third book, which is like a mystery about this Korean American woman who disappears and her white husband is on trial for her murder. So I wrote this completely other book and I was getting ready to submit that to my publishers. And then I just got cold feet. I just didn't want to write that book or didn't want to work on that book. And so I told my agent, let's just submit that Sense and Sensibility book to my publishers. And if they say, no, we just published one of those, then so be it. You know, we'll just move on. And then my publisher said, sure, you know, Jane Austen is an evergreen, you know, concept. So we're happy to buy the book. So I now still have that third book that I wrote and that I set aside. So right now I am focused on, you know, promoting and launching Relative Strangers. But at some point when the dust settles, I'll go back to that third book.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on the release of your book. By the time you hear this episode, it'll be coming out next week. So definitely check it out. Yeah, Anne, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Bulba. It's great talking to you.
Thank you. Super fun to talk.
And that was A.H. Kim, the author of Relative Strangers, available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Bulba bookshop. So if you head on over to booksandbulba.com and click on our bookshop link, it'll take you to our online bookstore where you can find Anne's book as well as a lot of other great listings by Asian and Asian American authors. All purchases made in our bookstore supports not only the Books and Bulba podcast, but also your local bookstores as well. Before we go, just a quick reminder that for the month of April, our book club pick is Yellowface by R.F. Kuang, a story about publishing industry shenanigans and the lengths some people will go to find success, including stealing the identity of their best friend. Really excited to get into this story with you all. Rebecca Kuang has written some of my favorite books, and you can always count on her books to include some messed up scenes that will make us feel things on whether we want to or not. And for our Patreon supporters, this month we're going to try something new. I'll be trying to read this book along with you all. So every week, starting next week, I'll be reading 8 chapters and holding a discussion about those 8 chapters on our Books and Bulba Discord. So if you are a Patreon supporter, please join me on Fridays to talk about the story in real time. And for the rest of you, if you finish the book early and have some thoughts to share, you can also let us know what you think on our Goodreads forums. As always, we love to include feedback from our listeners in our discussion episodes whenever possible. So we always appreciate our listeners sharing their thoughts about the books that we read. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Bulba. Thanks once again to A.H. Kim for joining us, and we'll see y'all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Bulba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandbulba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandbulba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Bulba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account.
Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
I'm Charlene Kay. I'm a musician, songwriter, and guitarist. Growing up, I loved music. Whether it was pop, acoustic, emo, I ate it all up. But as a Chinese-American kid living in Scottsdale, Arizona, I also felt isolated, never really seeing artists who looked like me or shared my experiences. So after years of performing on stages all over the world, I wanted to create a space to highlight the amazing Asian musicians who I knew were out there, just not always getting played on the radio. That's why I started Golden Hour, a podcast where Asian singers, songwriters, instrumentalists, and music producers share their personal stories. And it's a space for you to discover your new favorite artist. Listen to Golden Hour with me, Charlene Kay, wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.